In more than a third of America's public schools, all of the teachers are white. And while the number of minority students is expected to increase in the future, the percentage of African American and Latino teachers is expected to get smaller. A new report by a coalition of educational organizations says that students achieve better when they're taught by teachers who look like them. A more diverse teaching staff will improve education across the board, it says, and begin to erase the achievement gap, the stubborn difference between African American and Latino students on one hand, whites and Asian Americans on the other. The report calls for more awareness, more training, and more money to address the situation. Later in the program, what may kill Major League Baseball's Washington Nationals before they ever play a game. But first, how important is it to have a diverse teaching staff or a diverse student body? How much does race matter in the classroom? If you're a student, parent, teacher, or principal, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Mary Dilworth of the American Association for Colleges for Teacher Education joins us here in Studio 3A. She's a contributor to the report, A Call to Action, An Assessment of Diversity Among America's Teachers. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The report says that while we all pay a lot of attention to the percentages of minority students in public schools, a great deal less attention is paid to the percentages of minority teachers. How come?
I think our interests are always focused primarily on youngsters and how best they learn. And as a secondary thought, the teachers who are teaching them. There's a popular belief among a lot of folks that anyone can be a good teacher and anyone can teach almost any child, mm-hmm. and that's incorrect. Our report focuses on issues of closing the achievement gap among the number of youngsters that we have, the variety of youngsters we have in our nation's capital, in our nation generally,
right.
And points out the need and necessity for a quality teaching force, and that quality represents diversity as well.
Mm-hmm. How did this happen? I mean, didn't it used to, particularly amongst African Americans, I guess Latinos, their numbers have increased more lately, but in the past, didn't there used to be a steady population of black teachers?
Yes, certainly a number of years ago. This is not a new issue. The people of color are just like any other kind of person who goes to college. They pursue occupations where they see opportunity, where they find satisfaction, compensation, and rewards for their work. Around 1972, there was a teacher surplus, and it happened at the same time where we had new and additional federal support for going to college, educational opportunity. And women and minorities got the clear message that they would be able to enter into occupations other than teaching where they typically had been situated and took advantage of that. So for a long period of time, from 1972 to 1985, very few people were going into teaching generally and women and minorities specifically.
Now, when you said earlier there was a perception that a good teacher should be able to teach anybody, and that's incorrect, you mean, does the report suggest that we need black teachers for black students, Latino teachers for Latino students, white teachers for white students, and men for boys, women for girls?
Not at all. Not at all. What the report tries to point out is that we clearly have a teaching force that is 90% white, but then we have a pre-kindergarten through 12 population that is 40% diverse, other than white. Mm. And that there are a number of things that we need to do to be able to teach all children well. What we have found is that it is very difficult for the majority population frequently to be able to communicate in a culturally sensitive and competent way with youngsters from these varying backgrounds, and that what we've also found is that teachers from these diverse communities and groups can more easily communicate with these youngsters and have a greater and better impact on their academic achievements eventually. Teachers of color don't have to be matched with their students, but the fact that a approximately 40% of the schools in the country have no teachers of color, suggest that we need more teachers of color just as a reference in school buildings, as a peer reference, so teachers can talk and understand the community and things that might work well with youngsters from different backgrounds.
One other point, the No Child Left Behind Act. This is a measure that's very important in education across the board. One thing your report says that the logistics of the No Child Left Behind Act make it more difficult to achieve, to get more minority teachers. What do you mean by logistics? How is this working?
Okay, two small things. No Child Left Behind is a wonderful thing. It brings our attention to the fact that all children can learn. But what it does not do is it does not say explicitly that matters of race, ethnicity, and language are significant components in terms of a highly qualified teacher. By relying primarily on test performance to gauge student achievement and teacher achievement, what it does is it detracts from other things that are very important for youngsters to be able to learn. It is problematic for low income and or other people of color who have a greater loan burden in order to go to college. There are higher standards that are required returning to school. And so those are difficult issues.
So No Child Left Behind contributes to the problem.
Yes, it contributes. Or it doesn't help it. How's that?
Joining us now to talk about how this issue is addressed within the Department of Education is Mike Petrilli. He's the Associate Assistant Deputy Secretary in the Office of Innovation and Improvement at the Department of Education. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I know you've been listening to this conversation thus far. Are the small numbers of minority teachers in grade and high school, public high schools, a high priority at the Department of Education?
It definitely is. This is definitely a problem that we're concerned about, and we're active on a couple of fronts to address the problem. You know, I know we just heard about the issue around the heavy loans that many people, especially people coming from a working class or middle class background, have after attending college. A lot of people say, look, I can't afford to go become a teacher because the salary doesn't support me to make a living as well as pay back these student loans. Well, just a couple of months ago, President Bush signed a wonderful piece of legislation that creates a brand new program that will forgive student loans for people who go in and teach math, science, or special education in high-need schools for at least 5 years. And they can have loans of up to $17,500 forgiven. So we really think that that's going to make a big impact in those high-need schools and able to recruit and retain high-quality teachers of all races.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, we are also very interested in supporting alternative pathways into the profession. We support here at the department a couple of programs, including the Troops to Teachers program, that really goes after people that are coming from other professions and provides them a streamlined way into the profession, gives them the skills that they need to be successful, but then gets them in the classroom and gives them a lot of support to be successful. And Troops to Teachers, for example, as it sounds like, we recruit people coming out of the military with a college degree. They've got a lot of great life skills to offer. We give them the training they need to make sure they're ready for the classroom. The great thing about troops is the troops are three times more likely to be from minority groups than people coming through traditional teacher preparation programs. So we're very supportive of those kinds of approaches as well.
You heard, I'm sure, the Mary Dilworth's point that the No Child Left Behind point does not help in this regard. Do you agree?
Absolutely not. I disagree. You know, I think what's important is to say that we can both increase standards for teachers and increase diversity at the same time. And No Child Left Behind is about making sure that all of our teachers have the skills and the knowledge they need to be successful to close this achievement gap. And that means expecting more from the people coming through our teacher preparation programs, not expecting less. Right. You know, we've raised standards dramatically for students in the last few years, and now we're kind of catching up and raising those standards for teachers as well.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Burkett, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Sacramento, California.
Hi, Neil. Yeah, it's Burkett, very close. Nice try.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to voice in. I'm a student. I'm a white male. I'm 19 years old. I'm attending a community college with 32,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually looked into this, and we only have one African American professor on campus. There are many of my classmates are African American. All throughout high school, I had African American classmates, but I've never had a minority teacher. And I think that it's hard for teachers to relate to the backgrounds of minority students because they don't come from the same places. And I also thought I'd ask a question to your guest from the Department of Education. Or, I'm sorry, not sure where he is from. But
that's one of them is from there, yeah.
Yeah, the mail, he said that minorities are more likely to come from the military into the teaching program. Is that because there's more minorities in the military?
Mike Petrilli?
Sure. Well, right. I mean, here's what we've got to do. In the education system, we've got to try new ways to get people to say yes to it. And we can't just rely on the traditional programs where somebody decides when they're 18 that they want to be a teacher. Those programs are going to always be important, and we've got to do more to make sure that those are high-quality programs and that they are diverse. But we can also go and look in other places, in other professions, other fields, where there is both more diversity, and there's also people that bring great life experience to teaching and go after those people as well. And that's one example with the military example, where we have some highly qualified, highly trained people who tend to retire with still many years ahead of them willing to work. And it's turned out they've been excellent teachers. You know, they come in, they're more likely to go teach in urban areas or remote rural areas. They tend to stay in those schools longer. They have a real commitment to those communities. It's been very successful. So we just need to be innovative. I really just believe that we can work harder and smarter to get people to come into teaching. You know, we certainly do not need to lower our standards.
Mary Dilworth, I know your report suggests, among other things, reaching out to junior colleges like the one Birkett is attending.
Right. I think that's an excellent. That's one of the one of the strategies that we have been using over the past 10 years and to increase the diversity in the teaching force. We have our organization, and one of the organizations that sponsors this report, the American Council on Education, has a number of projects where they are trying to increase the diversity at the faculty level in higher education, as well as in schools of education where I am situated. The one thing I'd like to say about the notion of troops for teachers and those alternative route type of programs, I think that they are good programs, but we need to consider when we're making a financial investment where we are putting our money. Individuals who are retiring from the military or other careers are not going to be in the profession for a full career cycle. And oftentimes what we find is some of these individuals are looking for an exit strategy from a career where they're unhappy, but not necessarily thinking that teaching is something that they really, really want to do, but the opportunity is there. And I think that we need to be very careful about identifying and including individuals from other backgrounds into teaching, because as we know, generally those that go in initially are individuals who, by and large, want to help kids grow and develop and have at their heart teaching and learning.
Briefly, we just have a minute left in this segment, but I did want to say the report says that half of the African Americans who take the test for teacher don't make it.
Right.
And that some African Americans might be intimidated by the knowledge of this, those sobering numbers, and not even try.
Right. I think that we need to consider that there are a variety of teacher licensure tests in the country, that a significant proportion of folks of color, African Americans specifically, have not passed the test. And yes, part of the reason is preparation prior to even going into college. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it is intimidating to hear often that you are going to fail the test before you even try.
Mm-hmm. Birkett, thank you very much for the call. Good luck in junior college.
Hey, thank you. No, I'm actually transferring this semester. So.
Well, good luck where you transfer then. Appreciate it. We're going to take more of your calls and emails on this question when we come back from a short break. The importance of teacher diversity in the nation's public schools, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about teacher diversity and student achievement. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guests are Mary Dilworth of the American Association of Colleges for Teachers Education and Mike Petrilli, Associate Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Office of Innovation and Improvement at the U.S. Department of Education. And let's get another another caller on the line, and this is David. David joins us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Couple observations. Number one, I came to teaching late. I became a teacher at 35 years of age, and I taught in a middle school environment in a very tough urban situation for 4 years in a northeastern city, and then for 2 years after that in the southeast, also in an urban district. I've got to tell you something. I think one of the primary things that I observed from my experience is that children will rise to the expectations that are not only set for them at school, but what are reinforced in the home. And I think that the environment that these children come from, more than any single factor, is a good predictor of how they will do in school, regardless of the age, race, sex, gender, religion of their teachers. Now, my first year, I had a young girl, a sixth grader, come to me because she was being raped by a cousin. These children were more concerned with survival. You know, there were drive-by shootings, all the rest of this. Children can't learn when they come to school hungry, tired, emotionally distraught, from single-parent families mm-hmm. with, you know, you get my drift here.
Yeah, I do.
I poured my heart out. I invested heavily out of my own pocket for additional materials. And I think that while I would love to see a more diverse teacher force, I can tell you it's not going to happen until all people come to school as children, ready to learn, willing to learn, and willing to, number one, respect the teachers, have respect for themselves to the point that they will invest themselves in their work and realize that it will open doors for them as opposed to being a thing that brings shame on them. Kids who were
David,
well.
I think we get your drift. I just wanted to get a response from Mary Dilworth.
Okay. David, I think you're probably one of our very, very good teachers who had through experience and probably through formal training a good understanding and connection with the community around your school. And what we are trying to do in diversifying the teaching force and in identifying a more culturally sensitive group of people is the same thing. Let them understand the same kinds of things that you have come to understand. I commend you. You're absolutely right. Just bringing someone in by virtue of their race or ethnicity or language is not going to make a change, but it will allow for greater and better communication with the community outside of the school.
Let me bring in Mike Petrilli at this point and ask one of the things that the report we're talking about. David, by the way, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
One of the things that this report suggests is that additional resources have to be devoted to address this issue. You talked about the troops program, but I think fundamentally the issue comes down to money.
Sure. Well, you know, No Child Left Behind provides historic resources for the education system. Spending's gone up at the federal level over 40% in the last 4 years, and a lot of that increase has gone into this teacher quality issue. There's a $3 billion teacher quality fund that goes out to the states and then to school districts. It's very flexible, and states and school districts can use it for programs like this to go after, recruit teachers, both traditionally prepared and those coming through these alternate routes. And provide all kinds of great professional development and incentives to teach in high-poverty schools and many other things. So there's money there, but, you know, we've got to find new ways to do business in the education system. And, you know, I would just say that we have got to maintain high expectations no matter what. All of us in education know that we do not have control over what happens in kids' homes or in their neighborhoods, but we do have control over what happens when they're at the school and during those school hours. And we can do an awful lot during that day, and there are schools all over this country that are getting the job done, that are closing the achievement gap, and that are making sure that all kids are meeting high expectations. And we need teachers who are willing to teach in those schools and willing to hold kids to high expectations and get the job done. And, you know, we want all the highly qualified teachers we can get. And I certainly hope your listeners out there may consider a career in education, because there's nothing more fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Mary Dilworth, before we let you go, mm-hmm. I did want to ask. I know you insist on highly qualified teachers and highly qualified students. Is the approach that the administration is laying out the best way, or do you need more?
I wouldn't go so far as to say the best way. I would say that it is a good way, but I would say that there's more that can be done. I believe that by clearly stating explicitly that highly qualified teacher means that you're also culturally competent will do a great deal in terms of encouraging states and vicinities to do what it is that we think will be helpful in this regard in the year to come.
Mike Petrilli, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Mike Petrilli, Associate Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Office of Innovation and Improvement at the U.S. Department of Education, joined us by phone from his office here in Washington. And Mary Dilworth was kind enough to be with us here in Studio 3A. She's with the American Association of Colleges for Teachers Education. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Now with us is Lisa Delpit. She's Executive Director of the Center for Urban Education and Innovation at Florida International University and the author of The Skin That We Speak, Other People's Children, Cultural Conflict in the Classroom. And she joins us now on the phone. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi there.
I just want to ask you, we bring this from sort of the policy level into the classroom, how much does race play a part in children's education?
Well, race plays, do you mean the race of the teacher or
yes.
race in general?
Yeah, race of the teacher.
I think that teachers who are of the same ethnicity as the children that they teach are better able to know the background of the kids and also possibly what they need. They don't have as many of the issues related to, if you're not around people of color,
mm-hmm.
For example, then you don't have any evidence that the stereotypes that might exist out there are not accurate. Now, in other words, you may expect less because there are stereotypes out in the world that suggest, for example, that African Americans are less capable academically.
So white teachers, you're suggesting, expect less from African-American or Latino students?
I would never say white teachers expect less from African-American students. What I'm saying is if you don't have a background and knowledge about African-American people and and haven't spent time with them, then you may be more susceptible to those negative stereotypes. That's what I'm saying on that. So in that sense, you may expect less if you haven't. And if you expect less, then you'll get less.
In one book, you specifically write about culture and language in the classroom. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I think you might need to ask me a little bit more of a question.
Okay.
That's about two books worth.
Well, in terms of its relation to this specific topic, in terms of the language that teachers use with their students.
Well, there's the language that teachers use, and there's also the interpretation of language. There's a tendency for folk to interpret certain linguistic patterns as less capable and an indication of less intelligence. One of the instances I worked with a woman who was a speech pathologist, and she was sent, a woman was sent to her who was a black woman who was exceptional in her field with computers. And the company that employed the woman kept sending the woman out and saying, yes, she is the most brilliant person who can do this work. She was an African-American woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept getting the company kept getting negative notices that she must not be very intelligent because of her speech patterns. So they were desperate they sent her to a speech pathologist actually to try to reduce her, to change her linguistic form because the folk in the field weren't able to accept her brilliance
mm-hmm.
because of a certain linguistic form. Now that is something that affects teachers in classrooms as well. They're not immune to it.
In terms of accents or the phraseology that they use.
Or Ebonics, the terminology that folk that's using African-American speech patterns, however one might want to, mm-hmm. to name it.
Yeah, but it could easily apply to a white teacher with a country accent as well.
It possibly could,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Yeah, right.
Or children with a, quote, country accent in the classroom of a teacher who does not have one. As a matter of fact, Appalachian children are frequently viewed by their teachers as less capable if they have strong Appalachian accents.
Let's get some more callers on the line, and let's go with Sylvia. And Sylvia is calling from Interior, South Dakota.
Yes, my concern is when we talk about academic standards, and it seems that the students are tested and the teachers are expected to do this of one way of learning, isolated facts and factoids. That's what standardized tests are.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that there are a lot of groups of people, including minority whites, as well as other cultures, that's not learning. They look at the whole picture, and testing on these isolated facts and factoids does not teach students how to contemplate or do problem solving. And I'm thinking that that's more of a problem with No Child Left Behind, because there's only one way of making the students and the teachers be responsible. And I'm wondering if there's some comment about that.
Lisa Delpit?
I totally agree with you, actually, caller. And one of the problems that we're seeing in a lot of classrooms is that the teaching actually becomes very reductionist. In other words, all the exciting, interesting things that actually holds kids' attention frequently gets dropped by the wayside, particularly in low-income classrooms, but not just there, as I suspect you know as well. Because the teachers feel that they need, or the principal feels that they need, to drill the children on these isolated facts or factoids, as you refer to it, and so you see not only a difficulty in really assessing what children actually know, because they're such limited in what they're being asked, but also you're getting a real reduction in the quality of teaching. Because the teachers are trying so desperately to get these little isolated facts into the heads of these children, and the more they do it in that way, the less interested the kids are, and they tune out. So I would agree with the caller.
Sylvia, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Lee, and Lee's calling from Cincinnati.
Yeah, just wanted to make a comment on the diversity issue. There's just... I can't agree more with how important that is in schools. The problem that we ran up against, and I'm from a major suburban school in Cincinnati, is we would actively go out and recruit every spring, but the numbers weren't there. We couldn't seek these people out. And the ones that the minorities that we did get to talk to were very reluctant to move out of their areas. So it became it's very much a supply issue as well as anything.
Lisa Delpit, is that an accurate assessment from your point of view?
I think the supply issue, if you look at the pipeline of teachers to come, I think you definitely will see that. And I think that's why there has to be an effort made, I think Mary Dilworth spoke earlier, to get more folk in the pipeline, to get more people of color into education, to develop programs at colleges and universities that don't just look at new folk just out of high school to get them into teaching, but also programs that look at adults who may already have a degree in something else and who want to move into teaching, and create programs that allow them to learn to do that. So, yes, I would say that there is a definite problem with the pipeline issue, and universities really have to look at who they're recruiting.
We're talking about diversity in the classroom, not just students, but teachers. You're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Lee, I wanted to get back to another point you made. It was also, you said that when African-American or Latino teachers, minority teachers were contacted, they were reluctant to move to the suburbs of Cincinnati?
That's the experience that we had. There was a definite reluctance to even take a look at us, and I knew that salary wasn't the issue, because we paid amongst the highest in the tri-state area and in the state for that matter. So it wasn't an economic question. But
what do you think it was, Lee?
I'm not sure. We really couldn't put our finger on it. I know as a district. In addition to the recruiting effort that we were doing, we also spent a great deal of money and training on diversity training with our staff, just to try to gain that better understanding that we were talking about a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm. And Lee, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. And that's what I wanted to ask you about and follow up on, Lisa Delpit. The fact is, given the pipeline and the smallness of the pipeline that you were talking about, there are going to be white teachers teaching majority black students for foreseeable future in a lot of classrooms around the country. What do you say to them? How can they improve what they do?
Oh, there's so much that they can do, but again, that their teacher education institutions can do. We need diversity not only among teachers but among professors, so that the young teachers are learning from folk who know the issues that they need to teach, who've lived it. I think several of the bigger issues that these young teachers need to take a look at, and there are a lot of things, but several of the bigger ones are trying to learn from the setting, learning how to learn from the community itself, from adults, parents in the community. One of the exercises I take my students through is to tell them to pretend that you were called to teach in Irian and Jaya, and I use one of the most remote countries I could think of. And you're going to go there next week. What is it you need to know in order to be able to teach well? And they talk about things like the family structure, what the community expects of the school, the language, the music, the culture, gender roles, the psychology of the community, what the parents expect from education. And then I ask them, well, how would you learn that? And they say things like they'd go to the community, they'd go to the churches or to the places of worship, they'd go to the marketplaces, they'd go to, get themselves invited to dinner. And then I connect that to the fact that, well, if you are going into a community that's not your own, those are the same things that you need to know in order to be able to teach well.
Lisa Delpit, stay with us. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take more of your calls on this subject. We're also going to be talking about the local political issues behind the battle between baseball and Washington, D.C. City Council over the return of baseball to Washington. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking about baseball and Washington, D.C. The two may not be compatible, as we thought just a couple of days ago. But first, let's wrap up our conversation about diversity in the classrooms. We're talking about teachers this time. Our guest is Lisa Delpit, Executive Director at the Center for Urban Education and Innovation at Florida International University. And let's get another caller on the line. Richard joins us from Akeley, Pennsylvania.
Good afternoon, sir. And Lisa? I had a couple of things. First of all, I appreciate what you're doing in terms of recognizing community needs. To date myself, looking at the Ugly American story, you did exactly what they said needed to be done to reach out to cultures. At the same time, I think of two things. The first is a cooperative effort from the community to reach out to the teachers and say, here's what we need, and to see the school district as working through that. The second is something called an integrated culture, where I don't believe that teachers should be separate from their communities in any way, so it becomes less of a them and us kind of relationship, in which case ethnicity matters not. My background is I have a father who is a teacher, who is white, and my daughter's mother-in-law is a black teacher. So I've seen it from both sides and heard many of these conversations.
Yeah, I think you're right that is exactly what we need. The problem is we just don't have it, and we need to educate these young teachers to think a little differently. What most folk believe is that if we have the technical skills, and most colleges of education do, if we have the technical skills of teaching, that's all we need, just learn how to teach the program. Reality is that it just isn't right.
And I would say that responsibility should also come back to the districts, as to say, okay, we're bringing you in here. Part of our orientation to you and to us as administrators is we're going to learn how our community works so that we can help you be an effective teacher in our schools, and we'll take responsibility from that end.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the district needs to do that. I really believe, and I'm at a university, so I focus on this, but I think colleges of education have a responsibility. If we could bring in folk from the community, be they parents or leaders of community organizations, to come in to help in the education, to come into classrooms of pre-service teachers, to help to begin the conversation so that when the teachers are out there, they're a little bit more comfortable with it. It's not something that seems completely foreign and new to them. So I think you're right. We all have a responsibility there.
Richard, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. And Olani joins us from Battle Creek, Michigan. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that too badly.
Yes, Christine Olani.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to say, with the No Child Left Behind Act, I think that further takes away the voice of teachers. I'm a bilingual teacher. I teach Spanish in the elementary schools, and most likely my position will be cut next year. And so I'm looking at accepting a job outside of the field where I could possibly make more change, such as in the legal profession and helping Latinos on a larger scale.
That's a really sad commentary, Christine, and I have heard, unfortunately, a lot of stories about whereas there are many things that the No Child Left Behind Act is attempting to do, there are also things that are happening as a result of it that are really disturbing and detrimental to children. The focus has been so much on this notion of having fully qualified teachers. But what I can say to you, if you really look at what's going on even in that, you'll see that a teacher now, since they didn't have teachers, they said, okay, well, you can be determined as fully qualified by passing an online 20-question test. So, in other words, they just changed the criterion for how you become qualified. They aren't any more qualified according to their rules. And so to lose bilingual teachers, of all things, in this country is just, I think a sham.
And I agree. This is my passion, and this is what I'd like to do. However, I increasingly feel I need to go and get my Ph.D. in order to become the college professor that makes that change. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, too many people in minority are put in that position, that they can make more of a change if they have that prestige. And
That's a pretty high hurdle, though.
Well, I don't think the hurdle is necessarily that high. The question is, I think you can feel pretty unable to make much change at whatever level you're in. I think at whatever level you're in, you just have to push hard and keep fighting. And groups of teachers working together will have a much greater effect than one academic. So I think it's the notion of trying to gather, and that's what we try to do at our center as well, to try to get teachers' voices together and parents' voices, because parents will have often a greater influence, again, than an academic. So
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Christine, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And good luck to you. And also our thanks to Lisa Delpit. Appreciate your time today.
Oh, well, you're so welcome.
Lisa Delpit, Executive Director at the Center for Urban Education and Innovation at Florida International University. The report that we've been talking about, if you'd like to see it, can be found at www.communityteachers.org.